Please be seated. Okay, before I call our first case, I want to be sure that I have the lineup of how you all have agreed you're going to appear. We're going to start out with the Solicitor General for 20 minutes, correct? And then Attorney Essenberg for 5 minutes, and then move on to Attorney Jones for 30 minutes and back for the Solicitor General's 5-minute rebuttal. Is that what you've agreed to? Okay, very good. You'll have to kind of keep track of the red light if you're a 5-minute person, because that's not a very long time. So you're going to start out with yellow, and you won't have a whole lot of time. So I will begin with the case, Kochke versus Evers. Are you prepared to proceed? Please do. Oh, I have to mention that, thanks, Justice Bradley. Justice Abrahamson has already greeted the group, so you all know that she's on the telephone. But just to make sure that the record reflects that in our recording, she is participating in the case. She is not here today, but you may hear a question from her as we proceed. Thank you.
Thank you. As you have stated, I am participating, and I am...
Okay, we're going to let the Solicitor General begin. Justice Abrahamson, he hasn't started yet. Okay.
Okay, but I want to be clear that I'm participating not only in the oral argument, but in the court conferences.
That's
if
correct.
One is in it, and then in the court decision conferences and other conferences succeeding the oral argument.
Okay. Once again, Solicitor General, will you please begin?
Thank you, Your Honor. The legislature has already settled the representational dispute before the court today. In the rare case where an agency is sued in its official capacity, does not request that the Attorney General, the state's chief lawyer, represent it, the Attorney General may nevertheless, quote, appear for and represent that agency under 16-5251M when requested to do so by the governor or either house of the legislature. In addition, and also importantly for this case, it has been established in this state since at least 1860 in this court's decision in Orton versus State that an agency not represented by the Wisconsin Department of Justice and which does not have statutory independent litigation authority may not appear in the courts of the state except by special permission from the governor. Now, in this case, the respondents did not ask the Wisconsin Department of Justice to represent them in this case. However, the governor specifically made a request under Section 1M for the Attorney General to provide said representation. The Attorney General accepted that representation request. That compliance with the simple statutory scheme here settles the representation issue here. But, of course, that doesn't settle this entire case.
Counsel, what do you make of the distinction between 16525 sub 1M and sub 6 sub A with respect to the explicit assignment to the Attorney General of the authority to compromise and settle the claim? It exists in 6A, but it doesn't appear to exist in 1M.
Thank you, Your Honor. So 6A is the usual method with which the Department of Justice gets involved in a case, which is by specific request of the agency head. In that sort of circumstance, when the representation is done voluntarily, there might be some question as to the Attorney General's authority to settle the case when he has been represented by, when he has been requested to do the representation by the very entity that he is representing in the official capacity. That is why that specific provision proved necessary according to legislative judgment. There is no such doubt in a 1M case, because, of course, the representation there is often involuntary. That is to say, there has not been a request under sub 6. A different entity, the governor, one of the houses of the legislature, has requested the representation. So obviously, since a different entity has requested the representation, the head of the agency has no control of litigation under anyone's lights. There would be no reason to have a specific provision for settlement authority, because that would be clear.
And does that leave a question as to who has the authority to compromise or settle a claim as between the governor as the appointing agency and the attorney general?
That question has not been briefed or raised before this court. The position of the Wisconsin Department of Justice is that we have that authority because, of course, the request can come from either House, the legislature, or the governor. I could imagine in a future case where the governor or either House, the legislature, was the requesting party and they disagreed with the attorney general's judgment, that issue could be argued and briefed before this court. The Wisconsin Department of Justice, of course, would take the position that we get to settle in that circumstance. I could imagine an argument on the other side that I would think would be incorrect, but I think that if the court were to wade into that in the appropriate case, it should receive argument and briefing because that would be quite an important separation of powers dispute.
Counsel, you will agree that you are subject to the Supreme Court rules on professional ethics, correct?
Of course, Your Honor.
And how is it then that you're going to proceed to represent someone who, A, doesn't want you, and, B, thinks your position is incorrect?
I believe this court addressed that very specific issue in paragraph 18 of the preamble to this court's rules on the ethics of lawyers. And it spoke about the usual obligations that an attorney has to their client doesn't necessarily apply in the government representation context. And that preamble even mentions the attorney general or of the various states or of the United States as having that kind of authority. So I think that that paragraph 18 in this court's preamble addresses this very specific issue. So I think that is how we comply with the ethical rules. Now, in this case, the Attorney General is asking to do no more than what subsection 1M provides.
Well, counsel, on the ethics question, that would only come up if there's actually a material conflict, right? So if if DPI was authorized to take a position, then there could be a potential conflict. But if the position is under the authority of the Attorney General to take, then there's no conflict, is there?
That's exactly right. And I think that's exactly what paragraph 18 of the preamble is getting at. It's getting at the notion that when a government attorney, especially the Attorney General's office, is representing a state party, the Attorney General decides the ends of representation, the ends of the litigation, in the best interest of the state. And if I could give this court two interrelated examples that we mentioned in our reply brief, which I think illustrate this principle quite clearly.
Before you give those examples, let me give an example. You take the position that DOJ determines what is in the best interest of the state. This is a follow-up, really, of Justice Kelly's question. Is that your position vis-a-vis this example when the members of the court are sued in their official capacity?
So the way that it works in that circumstance, and some of the members of this court may be familiar with this process, is that when a member of this court is sued or is otherwise in litigation, usually the members of this court request the Wisconsin Department of Justice representation. If we then voice, you know, what our position would be in the best interest of the state, the kind of position that we would forward, and if the justices of this court who would want to be represented do not like that position, they do not give a request to us. They generally request the governor's request to get special counsel under 1411. So
I only know in my 23 years on the court one time that happened. But let's take last year's case. Last year's case involving Judge Gabler, and I think the state represented the Victims' Compensation Board. Is it your position that if you had represented Judge Gabler, that you would have required him to take the position that you thought was in the best interest of the state, which is contrary to his argument?
I'm going to answer your question, but I'm going to need to do a little bit of setup first because the context is very important. If Judge Gabler had asked us for representation, we had voiced that's the position we were going to take, and then he went forward with that representation request, yes, that's exactly what we would have done. If Judge Gabler did not ask us for representation, and he went and asked the governor for a special counsel appointment under 1411, then the governor, assuming that would have been granted, would have gone ahead and gave him that special appointment, and then we wouldn't have been involved in his side of the case.
We just appointed the Axley firm. Tim Barber represented Judge Gates. That's the way that we've done it in the past. But it's your position that we, just like the constitutional position of superintendent of public instruction, are obliged to have the DOJ control the decision of what's in the best interest of the judiciary?
Again, only in the very narrow circumstance when either the judge or judge asks for DOJ representation, or the governor or one House legislature requests. I'm not aware of any case like that. If Your Honor is troubled by that example, I think the reason that it could be troubling would be something in the constitutional authority of the states. But then we talk about the constitutional authorities at issue here. In this case, you have two constitutional officers. You have the Attorney General, who is the chief law enforcement officer of the state, and we have the Superintendent of Public Instruction, who has public instruction. In order to know what constitutional powers they have, you have to look at the constitutional language for their powers. The language for the powers, that's the word the Constitution is for both, is exactly the same. And that language is that they have the powers that are prescribed by law, which this court...
There's a preface to the superintendent's constitutional provision. I don't have it in front of me, but something like superintending powers.
That's true, Your Honor, but I don't think there's any serious argument that litigation is the supervision of public instruction. So we're looking at something else. We're looking at the additional powers. The powers that we are purporting to exercise here are prescribed by law, as this Court said is required in the Oak Creek decision. That's 1M.
Let me just clarify. There are no powers given to the Attorney General under the Constitution, per se, as opposed to the Superintendent of Public Instruction, which is given the power of superintending the schools of this state.
That has been this Court's decision. The Wisconsin Department of Justice and Attorney General obviously disagrees with that. We agree with the dissenting opinion that Justice Abrahamson wrote in the Oak Creek case, which Your Honor joined, but we are not asking this Court to reconsider that doctrine, that the Attorney General has no common law powers. But what's good for the goose is good for the gander. The constitutional language with regard to powers is exactly the same, which is as prescribed by law. If I may complete my answer, the Attorney General is exercising only here the 1M power, prescribed specifically by law. My friends on the other side want to arrogate themselves two powers that the legislature did not prescribe. Power one is the power to terminate an unquestionably lawful 1M appointment. There is absolutely no statutory authority for them to do that. But second, and I think it's important that this not get lost, they are asking for the power to have independent litigation authority. Independent litigation. Since this Court's decision in Wharton in 1860, it has been firmly established in the laws of the state and this Court's doctrine that an agency that is not represented by the Wisconsin Department of Justice and does not have statutory independent litigation authority can only appear in the courts of the state by a permission from the governor under 1411 or the 1411 equivalent that was around in 1860. So they are asking to exercise two powers that
Again,
are nowhere in
I
the...
I want to go back to us because I think your argument has consequences for the judicial system. You indicated in your response that the representation would be tendered by the court system to the Attorney General's office. You would state your position, and if we didn't like your position, then other counsel would be arranged. I'll leave for the moment how that's arranged. Why isn't that the situation vis-a-vis the constitutional position of superintendent of public instruction?
So, Your Honor, I think the question is, what powers do they have? Do they have the powers for independent litigation authority? And they have not pointed to any statute. This Court sometimes sees some lawyers not from the Wisconsin Department of Justice, often LURC lawyers. LURC lawyers have specific statutory authority to appear in a category of cases in the Wisconsin courts. The legislature has not decided to give the Superintendent of Public Instruction, or the DPI, any independent litigation powers of the sort. Now, you referenced that the position that has been urged by my friends on the merits could be voiced in this court, and we strongly agree with that. And there are multiple avenues this court has to arrange that. And I'd like to talk about an example recently at the U.S. Supreme Court in the Lucia case, which I think charts a very reasonable course. In the Lucia case, there was an individual who was subjected to prosecution sanctioned by the Security and Exchange Commission, an independent agency. That individual brought a claim saying that the administrative law judge that has subjected him to that sanction had been unlawfully appointed. The United States Attorney General, speaking through his Solicitor General, took the position on behalf of the Security and Exchange Commission that the challenger was correct, that yes, the administrative law judge was improperly appointed, and the United States Solicitor General, in fact, submitted briefs with the header Security Exchange Commission, arguing that that appointment was indeed unlawful. The United States Supreme Court, I think in a very wise and consistent policy, appointed an amicus, a respected member of the U.S. Supreme Court bar, to brief with full page count and argue with equal number of minutes the position that the Security and Exchange Commission's appointment of administrative law judges was indeed lawful. So in that circumstance, the Attorney General's authority to represent the agencies within that sovereign was fully respected by allowing the U.S. Department of Justice to make its arguments on behalf of the official body of the Security Exchange Commission. But the court's very important interest in having adversarial presentation of the issues before was also respected with an appointment of a respected member of the relevant court's bar to fully brief and argue the position. We would submit that approach is very sensible here. Now, spoken a little bit about...
Counsel, I want to turn back just a moment to Justice Ann Bradley's question and from a slightly different perspective. If the court were to be sued in its official capacity, would the governor be able to appoint counsel with regard to that suit under 1M?
The Wisconsin Department of Justice position would be yes. That issue has not been litigated. There might be constitutional issues with the courts that haven't been briefed. Obviously, the courts don't have the same only as prescribed by law kind of powers that we're discussing between these two constitutional officers. But the Wisconsin Department of Justice position would be that, I would assume.
All right. So is the answer, and I just want to make sure I understood it, is the answer to Justice Bradley's question that the court would be able to seek the governor's approval of the special counsel to represent the court because the court has independent litigative authority?
No. So the independent litigation authority like that that LURC has does not require governor approval. LURC is a rare entity. The vast majority of state bodies, officials, et cetera, do not have independent litigation authorities. They have to seek, under this court's decision in State v. Arden, they have
right.
to seek the governor's
right.
permission.
What I'm trying to figure out is, in response to Justice Bradley's question, it seemed that your position was that although counsel could be appointed for DPI, even though counsel did not agree with DPI, that would not be able to occur with respect to the court. So what was the reason that would not be able to happen with respect to the court?
I think there might have been confusion in some of my answers.
Okay.
I apologize. When the governor appoints special counsel at the agency's request under 1411, presumably the special counsel would articulate the position that my friends would want or that the judge would want in that circumstance. That's what usually happens. That's what happened, for example, in the Coyne case. The governor appointed special counsel under 1411, allowed in-house counsel to represent the view that my friends have urged. That was the governor's call. That is specifically pursuant to 1411. And again, since 1860, in the Orton versus State case, that is what this court has said should happen. There is otherwise no independent litigation authority. I think that the position...
We don't have independent litigation authority either, do we?
Not that I know of, Your Honor.
No, and you mentioned LURC, another state agency that has independent litigation authority, is the state public defender. And in 2013, they sued Judge Paul Lunston as the presiding officer of the Court of Appeals at the time. And you took a position different than the judicial position, as I recall, in that opinion. We appointed Pat Fiedler at that time, a retired circuit court judge, to represent Judge Lunston.
I'm not familiar with that example. Based on what you're saying, Your Honor, that appears to be disparate practices with regard to the judiciary. I'm familiar with examples where we've represented judges. I'm also familiar with examples where we've been requested to represent judges, and we've said, no, we can't do it, but please go to the governor under 1411. And my understanding is that 1411 request has always been honored with regard to the courts. Your Honor is raising another example where a different path had been done. And I don't want to be seen as fully articulating a position on the constitutional power of the courts that has not been fully briefed and argued. I think that can be cordoned off for purposes of this case. I think what is fairly presented for purposes of this case is the superintendent's authority, which is as prescribed by law. Again, we're only doing what 1M specifically permits us to do. They want two powers that are not given, and they have not pointed to any statutory authority for those powers. Now, not only is their position contrary to statutes, it also would lead to, I would submit, absurd consequences. In two recent cases that we discussed in our reply brief, the Wisconsin Election Commission was sued in sufficient capacity. One lawsuit challenged voter ID and 14 other election laws. Another lawsuit challenged our redistricting law on political gerrymandering grounds. We, the Wisconsin Department of Justice, upon proper request, litigated those cases in the federal courts, one of them all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. It was not relevant to us whether each and every one of the six members of the Wisconsin Election Commission agreed with voter ID, including its constitutionality, or redistricting, including its constitutionality. I think it would have been an absurd exercise for us to have to ask each member of the Wisconsin Election Commission, do you like voter ID? Do you like redistricting? And then,
but they are not constitutional officers, so you're losing me a little bit there.
That's correct, Your Honor, but this goes to the arguments about our whether most of the arguments were not grounded in the Constitution, they were grounded in the duties that attorneys owe to their clients. So
Coyne was fairly, I was on the other side of that one, but I lost. And Coyne set forth fairly strongly that that Mr. Evers, in that instance as well, is a constitutional officer, and certain things cannot be taken away from him by the legislature or elsewhere because it's given to him by the Constitution. I'm sorry, I see your red lights on.
Your Honor, may I answer this question? This is
yes.
Quite important.
Thank you.
This court's decision in Coyne obviously was divided. Our position is obviously consistent with Your Honor's dissent, but I also think it's clearly consistent with Justice Gableman's lead opinion. In the lead opinion, Justice Gableman, in paragraph 70, said the legislature may give or not give powers. The problem he saw there is that the power of rulemaking was given, but then somebody else was given authority over it. Here, we have a non-given power. There is no statute in the Wisconsin statutes, like there was the rulemaking statute, that gives the superintendent the power to litigate independently. That power was not given. So to the extent this court were to combine votes and opinions, under paragraph 70 of the lead opinion, there was no constitutional issue here because the power to litigate independently was not given. It would be just like if the rulemaking power had not been given. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Attorney Essenberg, is there something in particular that you anticipate we should focus on with your presentation different from the Solicitor General's?
No. I would say this. The petitioners have no position with respect to resolution of the representation question. We're confident that when this matter proceeds to the merits, that one way or another, the position of both the state superintendent and the attorney general will be aggressively and competently presented. We do believe, however, that resolution of that question is a matter of statutory interpretation without constitutional overlay. In other words, did the legislature, in enacting 165-25 and 1411, enact a system in which, broadly speaking, the governor has the first, the governor in the first instance has the authority to determine who will represent an agency of the state when the state is brought into court, and then a series of subsidiary rules that determines what happens if the governor does not make that request. We don't believe that that statutory question, which I think probably turns on the answer to Justice Kelly's question at the beginning of the argument regarding the potential distinction between 6A and 1M, resolving that statutory question does not require resort to the Constitution. Because, as the Solicitor General has pointed out, in both instances, the powers of the Attorney General and the powers of the State Superintendent of Public Instruction are prescribed by the legislature. And the legislature has the authority to sort out what happens in a circumstance when a state official is sued. The State Superintendent of Public Instruction, whatever constitutional authority he might have, doesn't have constitutional authority which permits him to block the involvement of any other constitutional officer in anything that might in some way affect the State Superintendent of Public Instruction. If COIN is read that broadly, then I think that that illustrates that COIN is ultimately unworkable. In this case, we believe that the matter is simply one of statutory construction, should be resolved by this court on that basis, and the petitioners take no position with respect to that.
Counsel, is there any statutory authority for DOJ to determine the Department of Public Instruction's litigation position?
The statutory authority would be 6A. Right? 6A makes it clear that in an instance where the state official requests the DOJ to represent it, that the DOJ then takes the litigation position. The question, I think, for this court, and as posed by Justice Kelly, is there some distinction between the situation that obtains under 6A and the situation that would obtain under 1M? That is, if, in fact, the governor requests the attorney general to represent a state official, does the state official then have the authority to direct the course of litigation that he would not have if he himself had requested the Solicitor General to represent him? It might seem to be an anomalous reading of the two statutes to say that when the SPI requests the AG to represent him, he gives up his authority to direct the litigation, but somehow retains it when the governor makes that request. It seems to me that it might well be a reasonable reading to say that in each instance, the Attorney General determines the litigation position of the state of Wisconsin in cases like this. And I think perhaps a common sense reading to think that the legislature would want that to happen.
Well, in either instance, how could it be that the DOJ would be forced to make a representation that it doesn't believe is grounded in law?
Right, or that the legislature would necessarily want a state official to determine the litigation position of the state. Imagine, for example, an instance where a group of plaintiffs brought a lawsuit claiming that the school funding formula in the state of Wisconsin was unconstitutional because it violates the equal protection or it violates the guarantees of a uniform and adequate education under Article 10 of the state constitution. It would be logical for such a plaintiff to sue the State Department of Public Instruction because the SPI, because they administer that program. But I don't think that that means that the SBI has a constitutional power to confess judgment, agree that the formula is unconstitutional, and therefore foreclose the state's litigating position. I do notice my red light is on.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Ben Jones and I represent the respondents, the Department of Public Instruction and the State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Dr. Tony Evers, who also appears personally here today. Dr. Evers. The Attorney General in Coyne versus Walker argued that the governor should have veto authority over rules promulgated by the superintendent. The Attorney General lost that argument. Now, the Attorney General wants to force that argument onto the superintendent in order to concede this case to the petitioners.
Counsel, let's start with the statutory language. And I'd like to go to 165.25.6a. Let's say that Mr. Evers had requested the DOJ representative, right? So with that hypothetical, 6a says the Attorney General may compromise and settle the action as the Attorney General determines to be in the best interest of the state, correct?
That's correct.
All right. So if the if Mr. Evers had requested the representation, DOJ would have the authority to dispose of the case as the DOJ sees fit, correct?
That is correct.
All right. So the here, the governor has requested under 1M the DOJ represent Mr. Evers, correct?
Correct.
All right. So how is it that, if I understand your position correctly, how is it that he would then obtain the authority to direct the litigation when, if he had requested the representation, he would not have the authority to direct representation?
Right. Well, the entire procedural history of this case illustrates why that is true.
Stick with the statute for now.
Right.
Do you have any statutory authority for the proposition that he regains the authority to direct representation when the governor appoints DOJ, but he does not have that authority when he requests DOJ representation?
Right. Well, the answer starts with the authority of the Attorney General, which is the authority of the Attorney General only has those powers specifically prescribed by law. So under 6A, if Dr. Evers had requested the Department of Justice to represent him, then the superintendent is ceding some of that authority that typically rests in an attorney-client relationship. So under those circumstances, the legislature has specifically provided authority to the Attorney General to, when voluntarily requested to represent an entity, a constitutional officer in this case, then that constitutional officer has provided consent to give up some of that authority. Under 1M, there is no consent to give authority. There is no specifically prescribed power.
All right. So that doesn't that assume a fair amount of your argument, though? That would assume that the DPI has the authority to begin with to direct litigation, right?
Absolutely.
Where does that come from?
The fact that the superintendent does not have any outlined power to appear specifically in this case does not preclude the Attorney General or the superintendent from appearing. The superintendent is a necessary party in this case. The superintendent is a named respondent. The superintendent could appear on his own behalf if an attorney is unable to represent the superintendent. And so there's no prohibition, just like there's no prohibition on this court to appear and litigate on its own behalf.
Well, counsel, there are distinctions our statutes make between those entities that have the authority to appear in litigation and those that don't, right?
There is some difference. There are specific times when a party is allowed to appear in an action. But I think there's a difference between when a party is allowed to initiate action, initiate an appeal, initiate a prosecution, and when a party is required to respond to an action.
Where do we find that distinction?
The distinction between required to appear?
Yes.
Well, The Attorney General has asserted that authority in the past. The Attorney General has asserted the authority to initiate and prosecute an action, and that was rejected in Oak Creek.
Right. But as far as the your distinction between the authority to commence litigation versus the authority to appear as a necessary party,
right,
and the effect that has on the ability to direct litigation, where is that distinction made in a way that is relevant to the DPI?
Well, let's talk about the Declaratory Judgment Act, for example. In the Declaratory Judgment Act, any party that is prejudiced by the relief or could be prejudiced by the relief that's sought by the petitioners is required to appear, or else there is no justiciable issue. Mm-hmm. And so if the superintendent had no authority to appear in this court, there would never be a circumstance in which the superintendent would be enjoined from doing anything. That's clearly not the case here. It wasn't the case in Coyne or Thompson v. Craney or any other time that the superintendent has required to respond to a declaratory judgment.
I'm not sure there'd never be a circumstance. There could be a circumstance if the SPI is a named party, as a nominal party, and DOJ does appear on behalf, right, and takes the SPI's position. And the result of that could be a declaration that and an injunction requiring activity or lack of activity, right?
Well, if the superintendent is reliant on the Attorney General's authority, which is not in statute, in order to respond, then that means that the Attorney General has the sole authority to provide any access to this court to a state entity. So the Attorney General would have such a broad authority to exclude any party, any state actor from this court that the Attorney General simply can't have that authority and doesn't have that authority because the Attorney General only has that authority that's specifically prescribed by statute. And if the Attorney General is correct that 1M gives the Attorney General the authority to block disputes from this court, to concede positions over the objections of its own clients,
And that's what I'd like to explore with you a little bit. I'm going to interrupt there because that's a very salient point, which Mr. Essenberg rather casually agreed with and then went on to the rest of his presentation when I asked him about it. Unless I misunderstand your argument, but I don't think I do, under the latter circumstance, which is where we find ourselves here, where the governor appoints the DOJ to represent the SPI, your position would be that the SPI could direct the litigation such that the Attorney General or his designee would be advancing a position which he or she does not believe is grounded in law. Is that true?
That is not the case. That is not what we are
asking
for.
Then it would have to be the circumstance that the DOJ would have the authority to confess error.
That is also not the case.
Then please explain.
Yes. So the authority under 1M is for the Attorney General to represent the superintendent. That's the only authority that the Attorney General has. And so here, the Attorney General has publicly, privately.
And you are saying, though, that the SPI gets to direct the litigation under that circumstance.
The SPI has the authority, just like any other client in an attorney-client relationship, to establish the goals of litigation.
Right. And just like any other attorney in the attorney-client relationship, if the attorney does not see the argument the client wants to have advanced as grounded in law or a good faith advancement of the law, they can't argue it.
That's correct. Absolutely. And it's
so why can't they confess error if they don't see it?
Because they cannot confess error over the objections of the client that it represents, because that would be outside of the scope of the authority under 1M. So the Attorney General, if the Attorney General needs to be heard on this matter, has the authority either to represent, say, the governor, who is a necessary party in this action, or if the governor does not agree with the position of the Attorney General, any time a statute is challenged on constitutional grounds, the Attorney General has the authority under the Declaratory Judgments Act to appear as the Attorney General and be heard on the issue.
You say does not have the authority under 1M, and I know I have a copy at close hand. What are you relying on for that? Go ahead.
The plain language of the statute.
What plain language? Go ahead and point, direct me to it, where the Attorney General would not have the authority to confess error.
So the Attorney General, as this Court has held for over 100 years, only has those powers specifically prescribed by law, right? And so in the absence of anything specific that says the Attorney General may dictate the terms or dictate the objectives, the Attorney General simply doesn't have that.
You're saying because that is not in this paragraph, 165.25.1M, they don't have that authority. Is that your argument?
Correct.
Okay.
And so the definition of represent, what it means for an attorney to represent.
So, counsel, let me just follow up on Justice Gableman's question. So if the AG does not have the authority under 165.1M, to do that, and you're saying the DOJ is limited to expressly what is conveyed by statute, that goes for you as well, right?
To an extent. Depends on the circumstances.
All right. So you, the SPI and the DOJ, they're on equal footing constitutionally, right? So if you make an argument that the DOJ can't do something unless they are statutorily authorized, that goes for you too, doesn't it?
Not necessarily.
Why?
Because there are only four bodies, there are only four state actors that have vested constitutional authority. That is, the Constitution directly provides authority to those state actors. The Supreme Court is one, legislature, the governor, and the superintendent. The Attorney General does not have vested constitutional authority.
But directing litigation does not fall under supervising public education.
To direct the objectives of litigation is a necessity for any constitutional officer to be able to be heard on what it means to superintend public instruction, what it means to...
Is there anything you can point to that suggests that supervising public instruction in the state of Wisconsin has anything to do with the courts?
Coyne versus Walker is the most obvious example that I can come up with, in which the issue in that case was what is the constitutional authority of the superintendent. And the superintendent, by its own attorneys, appeared and argued that it alone has the constitutional authority to promulgate rules, and it...
Right, so that was the substantive aspect of Coyne, right?
Right.
So the question of what is the nature of your rulemaking authority. But that didn't have anything to do with whether you have authority to litigate.
Well, if there is a necessity for some authority to litigate outside of the vested constitutional authority that the superintendent has, that authority has been given by the governor to attorneys, Attorney Neil Sistuin and myself, pursuant to Section 20.930.
That pays your salary. The litigation authority is in 165.25. In 1M, there is an express delegation of authority by the governor to the DOJ to represent, in this case, the SPI. So now, in light of that express authority, show me your authority that would allow the SPI to cancel that and say we're overriding that express authority in 1M.
Right. It is not the superintendent's authority that would be exercised in disqualifying the Attorney General. It would be this court's authority, the inherent and exclusive authority of this court to regulate the practice of law in Wisconsin to disqualify the Attorney General.
And are you saying that because of an ethical conflict?
Yes, I'm blatant violations of the rules of professional conduct.
All right, so aside from your argument on ethical conflict, is there any other basis upon which the SBI can say to the DOJ, in light of this express authority in 1M, you can't represent us?
The superintendent has vested constitutional authority, is a necessary party here, but as far as express statutory authority to terminate the Department of Justice unilaterally, There is no authority.
Okay.
It's this court's authority.
All right. So, so aside from your argument on ethical obligation, the only textual basis you have for saying the DOJ may not represent you is your interpretation of what it means to supervise public instruction.
No, the basis is what it means for an attorney to represent a client. And what it means for an attorney to represent a client is articulated by this court under the rules of professional conduct.
Okay, so is it your position then that the authority to supervise public instruction does not give you the authority to terminate the DOJ's representation?
We're not willing to concede that. There's vested constitutional authority being transferred here to an officer without constitutional authority.
Okay, counsel, I asked you for textual basis for the authority to cancel the DOJ's representation. Now, it's either in or it is not in the authority to supervise public instruction. Which is it?
So there, the textual statutory authority, there is no textual statutory authority.
Right. And as far as constitutional provisions, the authority to terminate the DOJ's representation either is or is not in the authority to supervise public instruction. Which is it?
It is inherent in the vested constitutional authority of the superintendent, but that is not a discretionary decision that we are making, that the superintendent is making. The superintendent is asking this court to recognize that the Attorney General has publicly, privately, and in its briefs refused to represent its client, has decided to act outside of the boundaries of 1M, outside of its prescribed authority, and that it is this court's authority then, this court's duty to uphold those rules, to say, Attorney General, you cannot proceed in the course that you have taken. And so if that is the case, the superintendent does not have to rely on any independent litigation authority, though this issue wouldn't be justiciable unless the superintendent is allowed to appear.
Right. That depends on your position that the SBI has the authority to direct the entire state's position on a matter of litigation.
But it's the superintendent's position that this court is hearing. It's the attorney general that wants to impose its view of the state interest on the superintendent.
Is there any reason, counsel, that the superintendent's and DPI's position cannot be vigorously and adequately presented to the court in the form of amicus counsel, as the state suggests?
Amicus for the superintendent.
Correct, and DPI.
That is not a position that the superintendent should be forced to take or must be forced to take.
But if we disagree with your arguments on the extent of the constitutional authority of the superintendent, and we agree with the state's statutory construction, would you agree that the position of the superintendent and DPI can be vigorously and adequately represented through amicus counsel?
If that's the only option, then the superintendent will have to find other ways to participate in this matter.
But that is another way, right?
But it's not the way that the law and the Constitution are designed to advance.
But do you think that his position, the superintendent's position and DPI's, can be adequately represented through and advocated for through amicus counsel? I guess I'm asking, is there any reason why it cannot be?
The problem is, then, what is the superintendent's obligation to present evidence or to appear and advance arguments and to advocate in his public capacity, as official capacity? Is he required then to comply with the directives of the Attorney General in litigating this case? I think that would create so many issues in the litigation that, no, I don't think that representation by amicus would be sufficient.
I'm not following you because there isn't necessarily evidence presented to us. There's argument presented to us on legal issues. So what if we appoint you and your co-counsel? Can you adequately represent your current client's interests?
Well, one, this is an original action, and so issues of fact may arise in this matter. specifically the issue of fact regarding submission of scope statements to the Department of Administration, for example. And so for an attorney, an adverse attorney, to be the gatekeeper of what evidence is presented or even what arguments are to be presented on behalf of the superintendent, that creates a significant issue. And if this court's decision then is binding moving forward, that decision will apply to all state actors, that the attorney general can dictate the position of all state actors in all circumstances, including at the trial court level. And so if the only way for the superintendent's voice is to be heard is by amicus, then we'll do what we have to. But it is it's an inappropriate solution with far-reaching effects if the decision of this court is that the attorney general and the attorney general alone can define the legal position of any state actor under any circumstance, including this court. And I think it also gets to whether or not the Attorney General's position undermines this court's authority to hear adverse disputes.
Counsel, I thought I heard what sounded like a non sequitur. You pointed out first that this is a petition for original action. Okay, so you're asking this court to take up this litigation, right?
The petitioners have asked this court to take up the action.
Right. And then you said, so it might involve this court taking evidence or deciding issues of fact.
Correct.
And then you pointed out what is an example of an issue of fact?
There's an issue of fact as to whether the superintendent is currently complying with one of the provisions of 2017 Wisconsin Act 57. And that is whether the superintendent is submitting statements of scope to the Department of Administration. And the superintendent is submitting statements of scope to the Department of Administration. And I apologize for raising an issue of fact at this argument. But there would then be a dispute as to whether any issues remain in this case that are to be decided other than what has been enjoined previously in Coyne versus Walker. And I want to come back to the court's authority to hear adverse disputes. If the Attorney General has gatekeeping authority such that in any case in which two state actors appear or a state actor appears and the Attorney General wishes to enter a confession of error, that would force this court to regularly, as well as lower courts, to regularly search for adverse arguments where an adverse argument would otherwise be. It is not this court's responsibility to search willy-nilly for adverse arguments that may or may not exist in the world, to advertise, to publicly say there's a confession of error and we're looking for somebody to argue the adverse position, even though, like in here, the state actor actually takes an adverse position to the position that is advanced by the Attorney General and the petitioners. And to be able to eliminate those adverse positions without anything more than discretionary consideration of what the interests of the state are, this court's authority would be diminished.
Counsel, can you tell me, is there a particular section of Article 10 on which you rely for the constitutional power that you referenced?
The constitutional power?
To appear and litigate.
The vested authority, the vested constitutional authority for the superintendent to supervise public instruction. That would be the basis.
So you're looking at all of the sections of Article 10. You don't want to point me to any particular one.
Section 1,
okay.
Justice.
That's what you relied on. I'm trying to make you be more specific than just say the Constitution. If you don't want to, that's fine. And if you do, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. It's the vested constitutional authority in the superintendent to supervise public instruction. Inherent in that authority is the ability to hear and be heard, to be heard on disputes over the boundaries of that constitutional authority.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, wouldn't that imply that any entity referenced in the Constitution would have similar authority?
Not necessarily. The authority here is quite distinct in that it is vested constitutional authority. Again, there are only
all authority mentioned in the Constitution is vested. So you have a DPI, you have an SBI. There are other entities referenced in the Constitution. There's nothing specific in Article 10 that says you have the authority to litigate. So wouldn't that necessarily imply that if that just general grant of supervisory authority, if that implies litigative authority, doesn't that necessarily imply litigative authority for any entity or person mentioned in the Constitution?
The authority of other state actors, whether explicitly vested with constitutional authority or otherwise mentioned in the Constitution, or even state agencies, each of those state actors has the authority to respond on its own behalf in litigation.
Okay. So they all have the authority to take litigated positions without respect to the DOJ. Is that your position?
Correct, unless there is something in the statute that modifies that relationship. Because the Attorney General has only specifically prescribed powers. The rules of Supreme Court, the court rules of professional conduct, allow for the attorney-client relationship to be modified. That's the paragraph 18 that opposing counsel mentioned. But if the Attorney General is to rely on that modification, there has to be some basis in statute. There has to be something that modifies the attorney-client relationship that would allow the Attorney General to dictate the position of its client. And that exists. That modification does exist under sub 6A and sub 6E, in which, upon request, a state actor could be represented by the Department of Justice and the Attorney General, and the Attorney General is then given statutory authority to take action that is in the best interest of the state. There is no statutory authority under 1M to do so.
Counsel, of what import is the United States Supreme Court case of Will versus Michigan Department?
Right. So in Will versus Michigan, the court said that any time a public official is sued in their official capacity for declaratory relief, that public official is sued in that public official's official capacity and is sued separate from the state. So when sued for declaratory action against the public official, the action is not against the state, but it is against that public official. So the Attorney General takes the position that is contrary to Will and contrary to the decision in this court in Burks that reiterated that position, that the Attorney General does not, in fact, act on behalf of the public official contrary to the decision of Will, and instead acts as the state, as the sole authority, as the sole voice for the state. And there's no support in Will or any other Wisconsin case that allows the Attorney General that immense power to act as the sole representative for state actors, especially when there are alternatives to representation other than the Attorney General, including appointment of special counsel. And there's no question, even though there's no limitation on the special counsel's authority under 14.11 to represent an attorney or a state actor in what the special counsel considers to be the special counsel's interest or the state's interest, there's no difference between the statutory language of 1M and 14.11 that would say the Attorney General may dictate the position of opposing or of the state actor that it represents.
Counsel, this is Shirley Abrahamson. Ordinarily, when the court takes a petition, grants a petition to take jurisdiction of an original action, the court instructs the parties to file a statement of undisputed facts, which is usually one of the grounds for granting a petition, or a statement of disputed facts, or both, as so that the court can look and see again whether the petition is really one that should be granted. Is it going to be easy or difficult to file a statement of disputed and undisputed facts?
You already did that.
Yeah. It would be much easier if the superintendent was represented by the counsel that is willing to abide by the superintendent's directives to enter into that stipulation. It would be much more difficult for an adverse attorney claiming to represent the interests of the superintendent to enter into that stipulation. And so in this case, if the governor is found to be a necessary party, as is necessary to enter into these stipulations of fact, as is the Secretary of Administration, there cannot be stipulations entered into without those parties. The Attorney General is presumably aligned with the position of the governor in this case, although we don't know, the court doesn't know, because the Attorney General is not yet a party. But assuming that the parties align just like it did in COIN, then the easiest, most efficient, and appropriate way to move forward is for the governor to be represented by the Attorney General and for the superintendent to be represented by in-house counsel with the authority given to it by the governor under 29.30.
In regard to Justice Abrahamson's question, though, we have granted the petition for original action. And my recollection was, though it's been a while since I read all this, that there was a proposed stipulation of facts that was provided.
No.
As part of that. Was there nothing provided at all? Not a, just a minute, Ann. Was there nothing at all provided that was a proposed stipulation?
There was no
nothing.
Proposed stipulation.
Okay, so then we are still in the position of having taken an original action, and we don't know if there are going to be a lot of disputed facts or very few disputed facts.
Correct. And we don't know if the governor has additional facts to add in this matter. I see my red light is on. If I might finish the answer
yes,
to the question.
Yes, please.
And so the statute at issue primarily is 227.135 under the merits. And that statute involves the superintendent and duties for the superintendent, Secretary of Administration to receive scope statements and pass that on to the governor, and then the governor to take discretionary action to veto or to approve that statement of scope. Right. All three actors must be part of this litigation in order to have an accurate record, to have facts before this court, and to have the positions of these, in the case of the governor and the superintendent, constitutional officers to advance their positions. That's the only way for all the voices in this matter to be heard, and unless the Attorney General is disqualified from representing the superintendent, one of those voices that was in COIN versus Walker will simply be silenced for no reason. And I thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. When you begin, you didn't address at all whether the governor should be a necessary party. Would you begin there, please?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you so much. Just briefly on the necessary party issue. There are three circumstances in which a party is a necessary party. None of them apply here. First, if relief cannot be granted without the party. Here, the petitioners have sought relief only from the respondents in order to have the respondents comply with the RAINS Act. Therefore, complete relief can be provided without the governor's participation. The second is a failure to join that party will impair that party's rights, including whether that party's interests and arguments would not be granted otherwise. The Wisconsin Department of Justice will be defending the constitutionality of the RAINS Act in this case. We hope, under Section 1M, as a representative of the respondents, if not as an amicus, again, we hope as 1M provides for respondents, so the governor's interests would not be in any way adversely affected if the governor was not joined as a party.
So you're relying on 80303, just the statutory criteria for necessary joinder.
None of the three criteria apply. Now, briefly, on the issue that's been before the court, I only have three brief points. I think Your Honors have already seen the textual difficulties, in fact, impossibilities with my friend's position under 1M. But it would also lead to absurd consequences. Their position is that if the appointment is made under 1M, the client under 1M controls litigation. Now, 1M applies to appointments to agencies, officials, employees, or agents. So under my friend's reading of 1M, if we are appointed to represent a line employee at the DPI or anywhere else, we, the Wisconsin Department of Justice, acting on the request of the governor or one of the houses of legislature, would have to take our lead from that line employee. We would have to take the litigation positions and litigation.
Counsel, when I asked him what the basis of his authority for that position was, he pointed me to the direction of the text of 1M. What is your response to that?
Right. His only textual source is represent. The paragraph 18 of the preamble of this court's rules for lawyers specifically explains that when including attorney general represents a state party, the normal decisions that are opposed in the attorney do not apply. So represent, as this court made clear in, and I think that's why the paragraph 18 is there. So that is really his only textual argument, and it fails. But I also think that the doctrine of absurdity should also take into account what would happen if what that's what represent meant. I talked about earlier.
Counsel, I think that he really limited it much more than you're saying. Unless I understood him incorrectly, he said that there are four constitutional officers who can make those decisions. He told us who they were, and the Secretary of Department of Public Instruction was one of those persons. Now, he said textually, if the legislature wanted to say that the AG's office controlled everything, they'd done the same thing they did in subsection 6A. They did not. And he said that they're not every line employee that the DOJ may represent, but just four constitutional officers. What do you say in response to that limited argument?
With respect, that is not what I hear them arguing. They're relying upon the attorney-client rules and the distinction between Section 6.
Well, let's have you address that argument anyway, because obviously it impressed me.
Right. So that argument relies entirely upon whether this court is willing to find in the terms of Article 10, Section 1, mm-hmm. an implicit authority to litigate independently. With respect, independent litigation is not the supervision of public instruction. So regardless of what rule this court thinks came out of COIN, which is obviously a very divided decision, mm-hmm. clearly under the dissent's view, that's not included. And I think very clearly under paragraph 70 of the lead opinion's view, because the legislature has never given independent litigating authority to the superintendent, there is no such power. If the authority for independent litigation authority had been given to the superintendent but then had been supervised in some way by somebody else, then we might have a COIN-like situation. But here we have exactly the circumstance that was contemplated by paragraph 70 of the lead opinion of COIN.
What about paragraph 88 of that opinion? If the legislature may, excuse me, it is not of the opinion. It's paragraph 88 of the dissenting opinion. Mm-hmm. If the legislature may, as the lead opinion suggests, take away the powers and duties of the superintendent, then the superintendent could be reduced to a role the framers of our Constitution expressly rejected, that of a mere advocate for public education. And it seems to me that's what you're arguing here. That is, that the language of Article 10, Section 1, which provides that there is explicit vested authority for the superintendent of public instruction to supervise education. It states, quote, the supervision of public instruction shall be vested in a state superintendent. Isn't that special? I mean, there are only four.
May I answer, Madam Chief Justice?
Yes, you may. Thank you.
It is true that we are on much stronger ground on the position articulated by the lead opinion or by dissent, which is the majority of this court. But I think we would also prevail under the views of the dissenting opinion with respect. Because the dissenting opinion viewed that there is some core to supervision of public instruction, and the dissenting opinion believed that rulemaking was within that core. Regardless of whether that is correct or wrong, I think it is quite plain that independent litigation authority does not belong to the core of public instruction. That's litigation. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. This concludes our argument for this morning. The court will meet in closed conference in 5 minutes. Thank you.